The 1999 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 126, Leaving the Fold, Candid Conversations with Inactive Mormons, by James W. with comments by Paul Rowley.
I'm Jeff Burton. I'm the chair of this session. You're in Session 126, Leaving the Fold, Candid Conversations with Inactive Mormons, by Jim Ure. I'm obligated to indicate to you that you're supposed to have a ticket and registered. If not, the registration area is out that way. You also had a survey form, and if you will be sure to turn that in. The way we're going to go here, Jim's going to take about 30 minutes, and then Paul Rowley from the Tribune, I'll introduce him after Jim is finished, will respond, and then we'll take questions. And we'll be done about an hour from now. Jim is the author, or is the prospective author of a new book, Leaving the Fold, Candid Conversations with Inactive Mormons, which he's going to be talking about today. Should be available in August of this year. He's the owner of Jim Ure Advertising and Public Relations Company of Salt Lake City. He is a native of Salt Lake City. He has a Bachelor of Science in Journalism from the University of Utah, and he's also taken graduate courses in art history. He's the author of three books, numerous articles. He's had all kinds of awards and recognitions, which I will not read to you. But also a very diverse person. He's a licensed falconer, a dry fly fisherman, a husband, father. He comes from a long line of Mormons. His great-great-great-grandfather arrived in 1849, and he has another great-great-grandfather who came to the Valley in 1862. So with that introduction, let me turn the time over to Jim.
Thanks, Jeff. Good morning. I'm pleased to be here. I'm Jim Ure, and I want to share with you today the adventures and misadventures of putting together the manuscript for Leaving the Fold, Candid Conversations with Inactive Mormons. It will be out in December, as I understand it, rather than August. If you were raised a Mormon in Utah, most likely the church is at your very core, whether you're active or inactive. You are part of the culture, and no matter how you may try to escape its influence, it always seems to be with you, like a kid sister tagging along. Through family and friends, Mormonism shaped your life, insisted you make choices, brought you joy and conflict, estrangements and communion. If you are devout, you know the church has the answers. If you aren't, you must find your own paths. You must find your own place in our unique cultural landscape by following another path. Sometimes that path presents uncomfortable footing and struggle, as you would recognize when you read the personal stories in the book Leaving the Fold, Candid Conversations with Inactive Mormons. Living in Utah almost demands that you choose sides on religion, and it's difficult to convince some believers that there is no harm in a thoughtful examination of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The work, Leaving the Fold, is an exploration of the LDS Church as seen by a number of well-known Mormons, most of them Utahns, all of them inactive, non-practicing, or infrequently practicing, in the church after having been active at one time in their lives. So these are people who are today inactive, though they may have been active at some other time. This is not an anti-Mormon work. Its purpose from the beginning was to create and foster understanding. My interest in this particular work started more than 10 years ago. I went to Sam Weller's bookstore and asked him if he had anything on Jack Mormons. There was nothing there. As time passed, I looked at it first, coming from an advertising background, as a work that might be an attitude survey, such as you would do with a marketing study or attitude surveys like focus groups create. But as time went on, I talked to Richard Cagle, a professor of marketing at Brigham Young University, and Cagle convinced me that the best way to do this was probably through personal interviews. That's what I finally embarked upon. And I'll talk more about that process in a few minutes. But first, what is an inactive Mormon? There's no reference available to the public that indicates a person's level of activity in the LDS Church, so I established three criteria that my interview subjects had to meet. They had to be members of the church, not excommunicated or disfellowshipped, and not having asked to have their names removed from the official rolls. Number two, they once actively attended church functions. And number three, they don't regularly attend church at the present time, and they don't pay tithing. Avoided were those who Peggy Fletcher Stack calls evangelical Jack Mormons, those who regularly and vigorously foment against the church. And I also avoided those transitioning out of the church. This isn't the place for their stories. Sought were men and women of intelligence who offered thoughtful commentaries as a result of life experience within the LDS community. This sampling was never intended to be representative. A representative reflection of the attitudes of inactives, but you'll find recurring themes: repulsed by the zeal of an individual, intellectualized rejection of doctrine, an inactive parent, the politics of gender, and politics in general. Politics are a strong theme throughout most of these interviews. Now let's talk for a minute about the statistics of Mormonism in Utah. Utah politicians have long operated on the assumption that the state is one-third active Mormon, one-third inactive Mormon, and one-third Gentile. At the turn of the 21st century, does this ratio still hold up? I turn to Dan Jones for answers to that. Dan Jones, as most of you know, is the noted Utah pollster. He works for both the church, for KSL Television, for the Deseret News, and a number of businesses in the state. I asked him to summarize the statistical status of actives and inactives of the LDS Church in Utah, and figures which his company has developed as a result of their long-term research for the organizations that I mentioned. This is the way he breaks it down for me. 69% of all Utahns are Mormon. Of that number, 55%, a little more than half, claim to be very active. Another 20% claim to be somewhat active. And a 25% figure claim to be inactive. Jones figures differ from those generated by the church itself, he says, which claims that 75% of Utah is Mormon and that 60% of those are very active. But I quote Jones here, however, tithing receipts don't match those claims. And he adds that Brigham Young University's Department of Sociology has independently confirmed his 69% figure. In addition, 75% of all LDS call themselves Republicans. Inactives are definitely more liberal, Jones adds. Perceptions of the very active are that they pay full tithing, attend church regularly, and have current temple recommends. According to these figures, 45% of all Mormons in Utah are what the church itself would call less active. Let's look at Jones's percentages as numbers then. Of the state's roughly 2 million population as of 1997, approximately 1.4 million are Mormon. 770,000 of that number are active. 280,000 are somewhat active, and 350,000 are inactive. The church now counts on its rolls 10 million people. If Utah's figures represented members everywhere, some 2.5 million Mormons worldwide are inactive. What about the title of this book, Leaving the Fold, Candid Conversations with Inactive Mormons? Many of the interviewees, when we first started, used the word Jack Mormon to describe their status within the LDS Church, while others objected to this name. It is a term that has risen to popular use and is often applied to those less active. It has an interesting history. One of the first references to Jack Mormons came from B.H. Roberts' Comprehensive History of the Church, Volume 2, page 322, in a footnote. Apparently, Thomas C. Sharp, editor of the Warsaw Signal, an anti-Mormon newspaper of the 1840s, was one of the first to use the expression Jack Mason to refer to anyone who refused to take part in the anti-Mason activities of the 1830s. Of the 1830s. Sharp later used the term Jack Mormon to refer to people who were not members of the Mormon Church but sympathized with the Mormons and refused to terrorize and punish them. For many years thereafter, the term referred to anyone who supported or sympathized with the church who was not a Mormon, and Thomas Kane comes to mind foremost as one of those. Today, the term has taken on a different meaning, but no one seems to be able to offer a fully satisfactory explanation of how it evolved. Suggested as analogs for the current use of Jack Mormon are Jack Salmon and Jack Pine. For Washington State fishermen, Jack Salmon are young, undeveloped salmon which attempt to spawn. In Northwestern timbermen's parlance, Jack Pines are small pines not yet big enough to harvest. There's also a separate species of Jack Pine, a pine called a Jack Pine. Now, this usage would hint that Jack Mormons have yet to fully effloresce, perhaps an intimation that they will mature, see the light, and become full members, an implication many inactives would find objectionable and condescending. Larry Skidmore of the church's historical department in Salt Lake says the term now refers to anyone who is a member of the Mormon Church who may not keep the word of wisdom or other church commandments, who doesn't live his religion, who isn't valiant in promoting the church. No one term can accurately characterize all of the interviewees, since all are different. An Orthodox doesn't really describe them, since many active tithe-paying members of the LDS Church fit that category. Neither does liberal Mormon, which implies politics. Backsliders, too pejorative, Mormons off the beaten track, depends on one's point of view. Official church language calls inactives the less active. Lapsed Mormon is occasionally used, but it's deficient as well, meaning falling away from a moral standard, or, as the dictionary puts it, a falling or slipping into a lower condition. None has the same meaning as Jack Mormon. The term feels just right, even a little jaunty. Jack Mormon is in popular use and has a meaning that virtually everyone in the Mountain States understands. Now let me talk about arranging and conducting the interviews. At the outset, I sketched a list of about 75 people that I felt would meet the criteria I mentioned before. And if you've lived in Utah all your life, and if you've been part of the Mormon milieu, it isn't difficult to identify the activity status of the fellow Mormon. You kind of watch which punch bowl they go to. The next step required a certain delicacy, since I was encroaching on the most personal of psychic space. And I would call the individual. I would, at that point, give them an overview of the project, tell them what I was doing, including my criteria for interview subjects. They were then asked if they felt they fit the criteria. If the answer was no, I thanked them for hearing me out. If they answered yes, an appointment was made for an interview, and usually that interview was in the setting of their choice in their home or office. If they agreed to consider an interview, I sent them a printed overview of the project. A few people I called were not Mormon. Surprise to me. Three calls turned out to be active Mormons. There were a number of possible subjects who, for various reasons, were not interviewed. One woman declined as she was in the process of being called in by her local church authorities for questioning. One former beauty queen was about to become active again. Two members of the gay community who were still on the rolls agreed to interviews, but then backed out due to possible repercussions. Interestingly, a number of inactive women and one man in the arts community at first accepted interviews, but then declined, fearing financial repercussions or problems. Interestingly, a number of follow-up conversations with those people indicated they feared economic consequences as a result of revealing their status. And I had several people who felt that way, not just those people in the arts. Still, they seemed to be the most sensitive about it. Some turndowns had to do with possibly hurting active family members. One famous athlete simply said, "It would kill my mother." In two instances, interviews were completed before I learned my subjects had been excommunicated, and I reluctantly decided not to include them, but I thank those two women very much for their courage and stories, but they belong elsewhere. One interview went on for over an hour before my elderly subject revealed he was currently active in church affairs, this in spite of my conversations with him and the materials I'd sent ahead. In total, I taped 42 interviews, and after transcription, I set aside 10 I didn't feel fit the criteria. The initial manuscript ran more than 800 double-spaced pages and would have been excessively expensive to publish. A decision had to be made: fewer complete interviews or excerpts from all. In looking at the manuscript, I saw that the interviews fell into two distinct categories: those who'd left active LDS membership when they were older and those who'd left as adolescents or as young adults. With the support of the publisher, I decided to feature in this volume mostly the interviews of those who left activity when they were older. A second volume may follow, which could include the interviews of those whose decision to leave came as younger, in their younger years. All interviews took place during the last half of 1996 and the first half of 1997. Each interview was transferred from tape to computer disc, and printed transcriptions were then checked against the recordings. Each interview was edited in draft form, and all were returned for a final view for accuracy by the interviewees. This was to make certain of names and spellings and to avoid mistakes that may have occurred in the transcription process. Frankly, I don't trust my own hearing sometimes. I heard recently a radio commercial for what sounded like chili-flavored Rolaids, and I swear the other day I heard somebody talking about a gerbil overcoat. Anyway, a few of our interviewees made a few corrections. Some made none. Some corrected extensively. The question of anonymity arose early in the project. Before I began, I was uncertain how many subjects would agree to use their names. Surprisingly few did not want to be identified. Those interviewed who appear in the first were asked four questions. Each of them was asked four questions. Have you ever considered having your name removed from the rolls? Question one. Can you foresee a circumstance under which you would become active again? What happens to you when you die? That's question three. And last, what would you say to me if I were president of the church? I'll give you a few of the excerpts that our interviewees gave us in return. Cal Rampton, former governor, former three-term governor of the state of Utah, I think I would define his interview by sadness at his lack of testimony. What he said was, "I wish with all my heart right now that I had a testimony. I envy people who do. I'm sure they're happier. The mind is at ease on a matter that it might be troubled about." Lenita Murphy, the widow of a former professor at BYU, I think that the politics of women's issues define very much our interview and One of her statements was, the church doesn't serve some needs. There is no voice for women in the church. Bill Mulder, I think I would have defined him by his intellectual opposition to the church. He can't accept the Joseph Smith story as theology, but he says it's a unique work in terms of American literature, very creative, imaginative, and influential. He also said that he felt that proselyting is terribly offensive to many cultures. Levi Peterson, one of the delightful interviews that I had, there were several, and two of my interviewees are with us today, and I'll talk about them in a minute. Anyway, Levi Peterson said, I've never been able to make a totally clean break. I've always worn garments. In the hot summer, I don't. He doesn't say his prayers anymore, but he was so conditioned, he still got down on his knees at night for many years. He says it was like breathing, hard to quit doing. Whenever I move, I always look up my ward. He calls himself an infrequent attender, yet he does go to church. I go to sacrament meeting and sleep. That's not a joke, but I sleep with almost total reliability. Once the sacrament's been passed, I'll sleep through two-thirds and sometimes the entirety of the sermon. People ask me why I go, and I will say, well, this is a place you can sleep knowing we'll rob or murder you. Stuart Udall, former U.S. Secretary of the Interior. If he had a message for the president of the church, it was, be more ecumenical. Scott Burton, I define Scott, he's an inactive Mormon who is gay, and I think his resentment by his granted psychiatrist really marked this interview with him. But one of his statements was, Ezra Taft Benson said you couldn't be a good Democrat and a good Mormon. It was as if the church said it had little respect for difference of opinion. You can see how strong the opinions of some of these interviewees are. Matt Johnson, a former state legislator, one of the leaders of the Sagebrush Revolution, I guess it's called. He's from New Harmony down in southern Utah. Very independent man. Another delightful interview. He said, I have a problem with the church calling itself the only true church. As in the course of this interview, I interviewed my mother, Helen Ewer, former chairman of the board of chairman of the State Board of Education, twice elected to the state board. She said, by its treatment of women, the LDS church is losing half its power. Betty Condi, she works for the Utah Education Association, former executive director of the UEA. I defined her by an awakening feminism that came in conflict with the patriarchy. Very interesting. She had many criticisms, but at the end of our interview, she said she could foresee becoming active again. After she retires, she says it's a possibility. Paul Raleigh's with us today, the columnist for the Salt Lake Tribune. He's going to respond here in a few minutes. Had a wonderful interview with Paul. He went to church and heard descriptions of evil people that matched descriptions of his parents. And another, the best of the interviews, is Ardine Watts, who's with us today. He said, I'm an historical Mormon. I was raised in the church, and I'd say that most of my habits of living, the way I think and my values, have been inherited from the Mormon tradition. I don't repudiate them in any way. He had an epiphany when he transitioned from active to inactive Mormons, to inactive Mormon. The moment of grace happened at 3:20 in the afternoon. It was just wham. First thing that I did was to decide to buy a pair of roller skates. The second was that I felt compelled to read a book which in my mind at that time was forbidden. The next morning, I was waiting at the library steps when it opened, and I spent 2 days reading that book. Could another epiphany return you to a conventional kind of Mormonism, I asked? At any moment. Ardeen also said, I've succeeded in erasing the line between what is spiritual and what is not. Every human activity has the capability of being spiritual. That just sent me. I love that. Ed Firmage. I defined him. There was a slow erosion of his commitment as his intellectual beliefs were challenged. Sort of the education of a liberal. Ed is a professor of law at the University of Utah. And one of the things he said was, I saw this universality preached better by different organizations than my own. The last interview in my book is from an anonymous government worker, a man I've known since childhood. I would define his relationship with the church by the overwhelming guilt and shame that he felt it placed on him. He's kind of a mutineer. We interviewed for better than an hour and maybe an hour and a half, and I was about to close up the book and turn off the tape recorder when he said, you didn't ask me the fundamental question. Why did I rebel and leave the church? It's taken me 50 years to figure that out. How does that happen in a devout, loving family? Parents loved their church more than us. I realized it after my mother told me during an angry exchange that I'd always be a failure in her eyes as a man, as a father, as a human being, because of my rejection of the church. We've never spoken about the church since then. It's been 25 years. Thank you for inviting me here today. I'd like to bring Paul Raleigh up, if he'd like to come up now, and he's got his own view of what this is all about, and a response, and then we'll take questions, I guess, Jeff, right?
Hello. I don't want to overstate this. I want you to know that I don't, I never go out seeking people to listen to my feelings about the LDS Church, or my feelings about religion, or anything else. But Jim asked me if I'd participate in this book, and I mean, I'm not shy if somebody asks me my opinions or my feelings about expressing them. The problem when you explain to people in this culture, in this state, why you once were. Went to the LDS Church and are no longer do that. By its very nature, it comes across as anti-Mormon because you have to explain why you left and why you didn't want to keep participating. I'm not anti-Mormon. I don't consider myself anti-Mormon at all. In fact, I have four children. Two are active, very active LDS, and two chose my path. Interestingly, the two who became active LDS or stayed that way are my two girls, and the two boys followed my path. I am equally proud of all four and equally proud of whatever path they took. My youngest daughter recently returned home from a Mormon mission in Russia, which I paid for. I would have given her the same support had she decided to go in the Peace Corps and been equally excited about it, or decided to take some other path that required my support. Her decision to go on a Mormon mission didn't ignite any light bulbs in me, particularly about, you know, what the message that she was planning to go express in a different part of the world. but I was excited and proud about the fact that she had a commitment towards something and believed in service somewhere else in the world. I picked her up in November from Russia. My other daughter and I went over to get her, and we spent a week over there, and I met several of the people who she taught in Russia, and came home very impressed with the lives that she touched over there, and felt that she had done good work. But that doesn't, once again, it doesn't make me want to go back to church or become a Mormon. We all, my children and I, and I think my children with each other, the inactive Mormons and the active Mormons, have a pretty comfortable relationship with all this. When my daughter first came home, I started getting these subtle hints from her about, well, Dad, don't you want to do this? Or, Dad, don't you want to do that? Or, Dad, this is a great message. Don't you want to hear this? Or I just sort of try and ignore it because I like to avoid confrontations with my children as much as possible. One day we were driving past the temple, and she said, Dad, don't you want to... wouldn't you ever want to go through the temple? And finally, I decided I needed to say something to try and put this to rest. And I said, honey, I'll tell you what. When I'm dead, you can do all the church work for me, okay? And she said, oh, okay, thanks, Dad. And she and she was happy, and I was happy, and so everything's fine. You know, I have friends, or a lot of people who are close to me in my life who get angry about certain aspects of the Mormon Church. My wife is my second marriage, and she has five children with the same mix. Her boys are inactive, and her girls are active. And she was very upset about the fact that she couldn't see her daughters get married in the temple. That's something that's been a very troubling thing for her. She's had two daughters get married in the temple. I've had one daughter, the other daughter, not the one who went on the mission, get married in the temple. And so I joke that I can find the unworthy parents' entrance to the temple grounds blindfolded now. But when my daughter got married in the temple and I couldn't see that wedding, it didn't bother me. And I guess people were up, because my daughter did what she wanted to do. And I got, I felt privileged because I got to pay for the reception. So my attitude basically is one of, I've got my own set of beliefs now that I've developed. There was a time when I was anti-Mormon when I was about 19, 20, 21 years old, when I was an angry young man. And there came to a point in my life where I thought, life is too short for this. And I don't want people to come into my house, take an hour of my time fulfilling some ward teacher assignment, talking about whatever they want to talk about when I think I've got better things to do. And I tell people that when I still get hit up with that from time to time, and they're usually pretty good about it. But one of the things about this culture, and I think one of the reasons why people sometimes get their back up and build this wall around them is grow up in the church, when you're a child and you go through the primary, and then you become a deacon and a teacher, and then there was a little. By the time I was a priest, was about ready when I bolted. But when you do all that, and then you decide that it's not for you, it's very difficult. I mean, they don't let you just say, I've got a different path for me. Your path is fine, but I've got a different path. I mean, it's like an all-out war to just try and go your own way, and you're resented, and you're a bad person, and so therefore, almost as a defense mechanism, you become, confrontational at the same time. I've now gotten to what I consider a very comfortable station in life, and that is that I've got my path. I've lived my life, which is totally away from outside of the Mormon Church. I have many people who are very, I mean, it's among the most important people in my life, including my children, who the church is very dear and important to them, and I respect that. I've been in the journalism business for 25 years. I've often joked that if for whatever reason I had to leave the Salt Lake Tribune and I needed another job, I would not go to the Deseret News because there are too many Mormons over there. I actually still feel that way, but that's not an anti-Mormon statement. It's a what that means is that there's a certain culture over there that I am uncomfortable with and don't particularly want to be part of. In my first marriage, I grew up with very liberal parents, and the reason that I went to church was I had a very devout LDS grandmother who I loved very much, who worked at the church office building. She was David O. McKay's secretary for a long time. She lived in the Belvedere apartments, and the entire apartment house at that time, they were all like her. They were old people, widows and widowers, and they all belonged to the same ward, and she had a real nice life that way. She was always disappointed in my mother, who became a Jack Mormon and then married my father, who was sort of the antipathy of what a Mormon is, I suppose. I mean, he had no religion at all and smoked and drank and had a colorful vocabulary. As a result of my mother trying to appease her mother, I'm the one who got selected to go to church. I became the struggle there was, as a little kid, being about the only person whose parents didn't go with you, and that suddenly made you an outsider, and that made you a target for various things. I can remember actually getting chased home from primary several times. I mean, you couldn't even be a Democrat. I remember one time I was when my dad dropped me off at UN Elementary School on the playground, and he had a Ted Moss bumper sticker on his bumper, and I got beat up for that. So... I said that I'd only speak for about 10 minutes, and I don't know that I responded to Jim's paper. They just asked me to come up and talk, so I thought I'd share with you a few of my thoughts, and I think they wanted to open this up for questions.
Thanks, Paul. What kind of questions can we answer? This gentleman here? Your question is, how have I an interest in those who have learned to deal with the questions, apparently, that inactives have dealt with and have become inactive as a result of that? Jeff's written a book about that very subject. Jeff, tell us the title of your book and a little about it.
Well, thank you. The book is for those who wonder. I think most of you heard it, perhaps. It's been around for about 15 years now. And it's kind of unique in that it's probably the only book that's being sold over in the Deseret book shelves that actually says skepticism is probably okay if you manage it okay. So anyway, it's available here at Sunstone, and all the proceeds go to the Sunstone Foundation. So if you're interested in it, check out the...
To extend a little more on that question... I've considered sort of an equal time answer to this book, and that may take more form as time passes. I'll see how people do that. I don't think I've given you the best answer, but gave it a shot. This gentleman?
Is there a consensus or a number of reasons why your interviewees decided not to remove their names from the church, number one? Number two, what about the religious opinions, religious and spiritual opinions?
why didn't people remove their names from the rolls after they'd become inactive? That is the question, and I want to make a statement about that. And then maybe our dean would have something to say, and Paul also. I found one of the strongest reasons that people did not remove their names from the rolls was because they had family and they had a heritage and they were not going to turn their back on that. And Mormonism is part of their lives. They're at least cultural Mormons. And I think the amazing strong ties that we tend to build to our ancestors is one of the big reasons that that so many people remain on the rolls. Maybe our dean has something to say about that. Paul?
Two reasons for me. Number one, if you have your name removed from the church, then you have to call them up, tell them that you want to do that. They have a bishop's court, I believe it's called, and have you in, and then you go through this process. My feeling is my personal beliefs are it's my personal thing, and that's once again going through their game, I mean, I know how I feel. If they want to, I guess if they wanted to just remove my name, that's up to them. But I'm not going to go through that process. I'm not going to go through any court. I don't think that anybody has a right to ask me to do that just because of my personal beliefs. But I also have a second and I think probably more compelling reason, and that is I don't want to hurt my kids. And I'm afraid that in this culture, if it came out that their father was like excommunicated, they would suffer, and I don't want to do that to them.
Thanks, Paul. I think this lady here had something to add to that. Thank you. I saw a question way back in the corner a minute ago. Yes, that lady back in the corner. The question is, have they replaced their active Mormonism with another kind of spirituality? And almost to a person, I would say they have. And almost all of them have chosen sort of a direct spirituality. Almost all of these people claim to be spiritual after, that's another of the questions I asked them, if they considered themselves to be spiritual. Almost all of them do. Not church going, but they've created. Of course, none of the people that would be included in this interview have joined other churches. There are obviously some people who've left Mormonism to join other churches, but that would be a different interview session. This lady right back here, you have a question.
You mentioned
how Levi Peterson. As I recall, Cal Rampton decided from the outset he wasn't going to wear garments. But I don't think I have any other information for you about it. This gentleman up here. I have three or four people whose interviews I thought were very interesting. And although they did leave at a younger age, I felt their interviews were well worth including. It was a personal decision, along with Gary Bergera, the editor of Sunstone, Signature. Go ahead.
I don't remember if I told Jim this in the book, but there was a point in my life when I was about 28 or 29 in my first marriage, and my first wife came from an extremely active, to give you an idea, her great-grandfathers were Joseph F. Smith and Heber J. Grant. That's the family I married into. Don't ask me how I got into that. But so there was a point where I tried to accommodate that and become active, and I was... In fact, I'll share something with you. I mean, this has always been something I've always kind of wanted to keep secret, and obviously if I say it now, it won't be anymore. But I actually even was ordained an elder at that point. That lasted, you know, it was like 2 days later I realized in my heart what a horrible mistake I'd made. And it was, but I kept it up for about 3 months, and I honestly thought that I was in the wrong skin. I mean, that's how uncomfortable and how bad it was for me, and so finally I had to tell them, and then I had to go through that process all again. You know, I don't want to do this anymore, and then that's you know, it's like ripping your head off or something. But so I did have a point later on where I tried it for a minute.
Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. We have a question over here somewhere.
This gentleman.
Paul, you mentioned that your grandmother was President McKay's secretary. Was that Claire Middlemiss?
No. Her name was Ruth Grismore.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know if she was her... I don't think she was his personal secretary. She worked in that office.
This gentleman back here.
I've already...
Sure. What... Let me read to you from the last part of this overview.
Don't forget to repeat the question.
What's that?
Don't forget to repeat the question.
Oh, yeah. Where am I coming from is in terms of my own spirituality and my intellectual and philosophical approach to this was the question this gentleman asked. I undertook this book to help determine my own place in our unique social landscape. Complex feelings of exclusion came early to me, and I didn't feel I could live up to the standards of perfection articulated by the church leaders. These feelings were further amplified by acts and comments of active members in both my family and in my local ward. With a head full of Mormonism and a heart empty of faith, I found rebellion replacing a sense of unworthiness, and soon I sought like-minded friends, many of whom were inactive Mormons. I'd chosen a path that took me away from active Mormonism, and as I look back years later, I was haunted by a sense of guilt. I felt lonely, disoriented, and without a cultural community, wherein once I'd known everyone in every house within a half-mile radius, thanks to my active Mormonism. My life had become painful. Feeling hostile and bereft of soul, I embarked on an exploration of my feelings. As an outgrowth of this, I developed a new spirituality, deeply personal, firmly rooted, satisfying in its delivery of answers and serenity. But unresolved questions lingered. I wondered about others who'd left the active practice of Mormonism. Had they found their way? Were they carrying baggage from the past? How did they deal with their feelings and their lives? This book was a journey to find those others. As I located them and encouraged them to talk, I recognized that for many, our interviews were an act of courage. In recognition to my interview subjects, I offered small honoraria in the form of epigraphs at the beginning of each interview. Some reflect the character of the person. Some contain messages. They are my thank yous. And the process was delightfully like selecting little gifts. As we talked, each man and woman provided me with another small piece of myself. I came to recognize the conflict created by some individuals during my early immersion in the church. I remembered feelings of disdain, hostility, arrogance, and defiance. But across 40 years, I recalled and felt the love of many active Mormon friends and relatives. Oddly, memory for me recalls fragrances more than words. At times during the writing of this book, I smelled the freshly mowed grass of my childhood ward, the acrid odor of burning box elder branches in an old stove at a cabin at Tracy Wigwam, the mothball scent on the Sunday suit of my bishop, tomatoes hot from the noon sun of August. On my journey, I renewed ancestral links to those who accomplished so much in settling Utah. The process brought me to respect the lofty goals of the LDS Church and created an appreciation for the integrity and unconditional acceptance residing within the hearts of those active Mormons with whom I worked during this project. We can all study the concept of acceptance from truly spiritual men and women, and it's this quality, more than anything else, that attracts me to an individual of philosophy or a theology. After a dozen or so interviews, I observed a change within me. I reached a state of comfort with myself, and in a shower of realization, concluded that it was no longer important if I was active or not. No one can force me to choose sides. Belief in doctrine is not a prerequisite to giving or receiving love and respect. A feeling of contentment came over me as I realized I had, in my own way, returned to my tribe, my comforting neighborhood, remingled my blood with that of my great-grandparents who first arrived in Utah in 1849. I realized that all of us, active Mormon, inactive Mormon, former Mormon, must pursue our own paths to salvation, and above all, we must respect each other in that. So maybe that answers that question. More questions? We've got a few more minutes. This lady here.
I'm curious to learn whether among that seemed very wrong.
has the question is, did we run into anyone during the interviews that felt that the Mormon church being singled out as the true church, as being the only true church, was there some objection to that, or did people? How did people deal with that? Almost every interview, people had objection to the idea that the church had a monopoly on truth, that the fact that it was the one true church, it didn't rest easy with almost any of the people that I interviewed, of all the 42, let alone the 18 or so that we put in this book. Does that answer a question?
I personally subscribe to something that Mahatma Gandhi once said, and that is that all churches are true and all churches have flaws.
This gentleman over here.
Give us a little synthesis, a sense of what the suggestions would be to the president of the church.
Open up. Be more inclusive. Understand the feelings and the difficulties that women are having within the church. The politics definitely played a big role. I'm trying to think of some of the more cogent statements, and they don't stick with me right this minute. But
was there any feeling of improvement with Gordon?
I think that was there any feeling of improvement with President Hinckley? I believe that many of the people I interviewed felt that the church had taken some new positive steps as a result of President Hinckley's leadership. But I think everyone agreed that any kind of change, and everybody that was part of this interview process was calling for some kind of change. I think that everyone agreed that it would be glacial at best. This gentleman over here. I was not. He died just before I began this project. I got close to him spiritually through a number of his friends, including Bill Mulder. Stuart Udall was close to Sterling McMurrin too, and Ed Firmage. All of them were pretty close. So he was the biggie that I missed. Sorry to say. This gentleman?
Yes, I'm interested.